I'd like to acknowledge Australia's First Nation people as the traditional custodians of the land, and for this episode in particular, the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
I think the best advice that I can give is you are going to have to work really, really hard outside of the limelight. You're going to have to go home and after a shift and be exhausted and still pick up a book. Or you're going to have to get up early and you're going to have to pick up a book and you're going to have to read and take notes and study.
This is Over a Glass. I'm Shantae Whale. Anthony Pieri has poured his fair share of unicorn wines. As a sommelier that has worked in some of Australia's best restaurants, he is a deep thinker and even better articulator of all things wine. I'm thrilled to have him on the podcast today. Hi, Anthony. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Shantae. Thanks for having me.
It's such a pleasure. I'm thrilled to have you on because of all the sommeliers that I've known in my time, I feel like you are probably, you know, no pressure, but you're probably one of the few that I really, really enjoy listening to talk about wine and you just communicate so well. So I'm thrilled to have you on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really, those are strong words coming from someone like yourself. So thank you.
Tell me a little bit about where you were born, because I know it was in the States, but I actually have no idea where it was.
Yeah. So I was born in the suburbs of Chicago. So kind of just northwest, I guess for my Melburnian friends, it would probably be like the Flemington equivalent. Lived there until I was about 16. And then my parents moved us up to Wisconsin, up to a tiny little town up in the north of Wisconsin. So, and then I went to university because the university system in the States is very much kind of state specific, unless you're going like private Ivy League, which was not me. You stay in the state where you have residence. So I did my university degree in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And that's kind of where I discovered wine and hospitality sort of formally. So.
Moving from like a big city like Chicago, did you enjoy being in Wisconsin? Did it scare you being in such a small place after such a large city?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I mean, there are, you know, stories that I've really never told people outside of my close friend group. You know, I remember we moved up there and I think we had to like, there was a wood pile in the backyard that had to be moved. So it was the middle of our sort of like summer holidays. So we were moving this wood pile, and I remember I think I like scraped my hand on a nail or something like that, and I was over it at that point. And my dad had actually stayed in the city and worked, and then kind of would come home on the weekends, sort of thing. At that point, and I was like, "That's it. I'm going home. I'm going back with Dad. I can't do this. You know, this place is haunted." I was like, I thought it was just so bizarre that we were, you know what I mean, like in the middle of what I thought was the middle of nowhere, but actually it was. I mean, it's a town of like at that point it was maybe 30,000 people or something. So it wasn't the sticks, but for us, I was like, "This is just bizarre. I can't do this." You know, it was quite confronting. You know.
And you found hospitality, though. Was that like a little bit of a, you know, like a lifeline in terms of meeting people and finding something that you enjoyed?
I grew up a lot sort of kind of in kitchens and in, in restaurants. And I didn't, you know, retrospectively, I can kind of reflect on that and understand. But at the time, you don't know. But my dad's side of the family is all Tuscan. They're from Italy. So, you know, very early on, we sort of had this, you know, in everyday conversations about the family, and they would visit us. Like, I remember them coming to visit us when I was really young. And, I remember one of my cousins having like a Prada jacket. And I was like, wow, you know, I was very fascinated by these Italian people. They're always very well dressed and they were very well mannered, you know. And come to find out, my cousins have a hotel in Tuscany. So we, as soon as I could start going, they would send me over, and I kind of discovered that sort of side of my life as well, or side of my family's history rather, that, kind of had hospitality almost built in. So, to answer your question, I mean, like, I remember my first job, my parents telling me, like, okay, you know, it's time, you're 14, it's time to get a job. And I was like, well, how do I do that? You know, and they're like, well, go, I'm dating myself, you know, go go to a place and ask for an application, fill out the application and hand it in, you know? And ever since then, I remember being like, okay, well, if I'm going to work somewhere, I want to work for the best. Like, that's just always been I want to work for the best, the biggest, the best, the most notable, blah, blah, blah. So there was this little pizza place in this town that was famous. You know, everybody had been there since the 40s. Everybody goes there. Everybody knows it. It's, you know, it's like, it's a namesake. So I went and walked in and I asked for an application, and they gave me this sort of application that you would buy from, I guess, our OfficeWorks equivalent, you know, just ripped it off of a pad of applications, very generic. And I remember going home and, you know, filling it out, making sure everything was perfect, blah, blah, blah. And then I went and handed it back in. And then I'm like, well, now what? You know, my mom's like, well, you have to wait a day and then you call. And I'm like, okay. So I waited a day, and then I remember calling and, hi, my name is Anthony. I filled out an application and they hired me. You know, and I was a dishwasher at this pizza place, and working there for, I guess I was there for like 4 years or something, all through, you know, most of high school. It's, you know, where I met some of my closest American friends now, and learned a lot, grew up a lot, you know, learned about, you know, I don't know, social dynamics and like who the boss was and what that meant and who the cool kids were and what that meant. And it was really, you know, I reflect on that, and there's some pretty embarrassing moments as well, you know, stuff like that. So that's kind of the, I guess, the beginning of my sort of hospitality. That's the dawn of the, the Anthony Pieri hospitality, I guess. Working at Faye's Pizza. Shout out to Faye's Pizza.
Oh, I love that. I mean, you know, I think some of the greatest people in hospitality have started as dishwashers, and I love that. Very humbling. It's good to see. It's a good place to work, just to see how somewhere operates, right? Like to see the kitchen and how that operates. And yeah, like you said, who's the boss that's wandering through, and you just, you know, you see them in their civilian clothes, you're like, who's this guy? And then you find out, oh God, that's the boss. So great place to start.
And it was, I mean, that was back in the day, Shantae. That was like old school, like getting screamed at, getting made fun of, like all of the really toxic traits that were working. I know you and I in particular working really, really hard to sort of beat out of our industry. You know, I look back at that and I'm like, oh goodness, some of the ways that I was talked to or that I talked to people very embarrassingly, you know what I mean? Just wouldn't fly. It's very, very, it gives you a lot of perspective, you know, 20 years later. So
certainly does. Well, that's kind of answered my next question, but I was going to ask you, do you remember a time where you knew absolutely nothing about wine?
Oh, 100%, Shantae. Absolutely. Yeah. And his name is Lawrence Turcotte, Larry Turcotte. He's the reason, you know, that I am in this, that I'm doing this. And he and Jennifer Munich, there were these two, and I worked. So after the pizza place, I decided, okay, look, I'm going to graduate up. I want to kind of like get out and do something a bit more fancy, you know, like, cause I was really fascinated by fine dining. I was like, wow, there's this whole sort of, how do you say it? There's this whole like world out there of people, because my parents were quite humble. We never really went to fancy dinners necessarily. You know, we would go to steakhouses and stuff like that. And my mom would order White Zinfandel. I always remember that. And, you know, so that's kind of what was happening, you know, in the 90s in small town America. And this restaurant was opening in this small town with this famous chef from Germany. And, you know, it was 9 tables and it was really high end. It was really expensive. They had all the best chefs. It was like this thing that was happening in this town. It was really sort of making waves. And I was like, that's where I want to work, because I want to work for the best. So I went in and asked for an application, and they're like, well, we don't have applications. You just have to call this number and talk to Lawrence. I'm like, okay. And I remember standing in my driveway talking to Lawrence Turcotte and being like, yeah, I really, you know, I don't have much experience, but I'm interested. And I can't remember the details of the conversation, but I was really, you know, and he had this really sort of booming voice. He was seemingly really well-educated, you know, like the consummate maitre d'. Like, we all have them, we all know them, you know what I mean? Like, and he gave me a job, and I was a waiter, and we wore all black, black shirt, black tie, and he would do all of the wine service, you know. And I vividly remember my first table that ever had a bottle of wine at this really fancy restaurant, white tablecloths. They had amuse-bouches. They had all these things. And I didn't know how to open a bottle of wine. I've never done that before. So he did the wine service, and then he set the bottle on the coaster on the table. And I just left it there. I mean, I had no idea what, like, I just left it there. The glasses went dry, and I was like, well, certainly they're just going to fill up their wine. Like, with, like, why else would you leave it on the table? I had no idea. And he comes up to me, and I'll never forget, and his little finger just, like, pointed into my chest, and he's like, you know, can I swear? I probably shouldn't swear, hey? Okay. You know, and he's just, if Jen Munich is listening, Larry would never listen to a podcast, but Jen Munich will probably give it a listen. I'm pretty sure she would chuckle when I say, he looked at me and he's like, who the fuck do you think I am? He's like, do you think I'm a fucking wine waiter? Get out there and pour the wine. And I was like, I just looked at him and I was like, in total shock. I was like, what's a wine waiter? Like, what's going on? What do you mean? You know, I just looked at him. I was just like gobsmacked. He's like, you're like, you think I'm a fucking wine waiter? And I was just like, then I went out and I had to pour the wine, and I had never poured wine before. I didn't know what I was doing. I was like, okay, I'm going to pour the wine. I don't know. So I just grabbed it and started pouring it. And I can't remember if I dripped anywhere. I don't think I did, because I was quite, you know, I had like read, I was very studious. You know, I was a nerd. I was a nerdy kid. So I had read about how you know, twist and blah, blah, blah. So I had done my best, and I went and poured the wine. And that was the first time that I had ever had any sort of exposure or experience with what it looks like to give service in a restaurant. And that restaurant, I worked there, it closed, you know, I worked there for like 9 months, and the learning curve was so steep. But the things that happened in that restaurant, like, he came to me once and he was like, have you ever heard of Louis Trez? And I was like, well, no, I don't know what that is, but it looks like a very fancy bottle, you know? And he's like, yeah, it's very, you know, it's very expensive, and it comes from all, he told me the whole story about Louis Trez. And I was like, oh, you know, because I'm, you know, gotta bear with me here. I'm kind of like a young, naive kid, you know, the kind that we train now, the kind that we get in our restaurants, like, you know, what are we doing here? And he, and I was like, oh, can I taste it? And he just kind of looked at me like, absolutely not. You can't taste it. It's, I just told you how expensive it is. No, you know. And I was like, well, okay. Well. And he's like, well, you can taste it if you sell it to someone. And I was like, oh. Yeah, all right. So the next time we had like the private room, I just started talking to this guy. I forget his name, but I can see his face. He was a banker, he was a very wealthy sort of middle-aged man with a bunch of men in this room, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, this is probably the perfect people that would want to try this, and I want to taste this. So I sold them. There was like 8 people, and I sold them all a nip of Louis Trez. And I was super proud. I mean, at that point, I didn't understand. I understood zero about sales, head spends, cost of goods, nothing. Nothing, right? And I sold it to them. And I'm like actually getting, I'm not emotional, but like I can feel my hair standing up. One of them didn't touch their nip of Louis Trez. So, but I had no idea. So they left. And I'm clearing up. And I was like, Lawrence, this guy didn't touch his at all. Look, the glass, he didn't even sip it. He didn't do anything. And in my head, I'm like, oh my God, I really want to drink it. It's after service. I really want to taste this. And it's the whole reason that I did this is so that I can taste it. And he just sort of looks at me and he's like, yeah, sometimes that happens or something, and walked away. And I was like, well, this is the whole reason that I'm here, is because I want to taste this mythical elixir that you've sold to me as like this amazing, you know, like the whole story. And I'm like, oh, wow. So I walked out and I was like, well, can I taste it? And he just looked at me and he's like, well, of course. Like, it was like a non-issue, you know, in my head. I was like, well, I don't know. You know, I was very nervous and anxious. And so I tasted Louis Trez, and then it was kind of like, oh, wow. Okay. I had no idea. You know, I think I still remember sort of burning my mouth and being quite off put by the taste. I really didn't, you know what I mean? I was a good boy. I didn't do any drugs. I didn't really drink. And that was also the time, and this, you know, kind of maybe gives you a bit of continuity to Australia. I remember him holding a bottle of Chambers Rutherglen Musket and telling me the story about this little place in the middle of Australia, which is, you know, how he would say Australia, he would say it, you know. And they only make wines like this in that little place, nowhere else in the world. They're totally unique. You're never going to find anything like it anywhere. And he poured me a little taste of it. And I vividly remember color and smell and sight. I remember that so profoundly that when I arrived to Australia, maybe if I'm rambling, just stop me. Sorry. But when I arrived to Australia, I didn't, and this is a story I've told, if anyone knows me and is listening to this, they've heard these stories tons of times, but I didn't want to go anywhere else. I didn't want to go to the Yarra. I didn't want to go to, like, I didn't want to go taste Semillon up by you guys. I didn't want to do any of that. I wanted to go to Rutherglen Victoria. So I did. And very much in the American mentality still, like, brand new. I'd been in Australia maybe 2 weeks. I was living in Melbourne. I was like, oh, okay, so it's like a 4-hour drive. I can do that. And so I made the booking for the hotel. I made the booking for the car. I think I reached out to some winemakers maybe or something. I can't really remember. I must have, but I can't remember. And I got dressed up in a suit, suit and tie, and I drove to Rutherglen. And I got out at the hotel, which was above a pub, which had a shared bathroom and creaky floorboards. And I was like, oh, geez, we're back. I was like, what is going on, you know? And this, again, like city kids. So once I was in university, I moved straight back to the CBD in the largest city in the state and stayed there. And I was like, oh, shit. So I started, like, I took my tie off nice and slow, ditched the jacket, rolled up my sleeves. I'm like, we're not in Kansas anymore. And it was just bizarro, you know. And I was driving around. It was like, wow. And I met the winemakers of Rutherglen. So we had, like, a dinner where I met Mandy Jones for the first time, and she's a legend. I always have her muskets on by the glass, certainly at Gimlet now, but, you know, in the past as well. And my first winemaker I ever met was Simon Colleen at Stanton Colleen, and I was like, I was fresh from Australia, and, you know, this is almost 15 years ago now, 13 years ago, and I was like in the tank room or something, and I was like, hello, you know, like yelling out, and all of a sudden, like, the big booming sort of Aussie, yeah, g'day mate, you know, and he's like up on a tank somewhere, and I was like, oh, Jesus, I'm like, what is happening? And we had a chat and tasted some wines and his vintage ports and stuff like that. So it was really, really memorable for me. But that all sort of started from this little restaurant in this no-name town in Middle America with Lawrence Turcotte, really sort of sparked the formal education and interest in service and hospitality and ultimately wine. So,
oh man, I love you already, but I love you even more from that story. I mean,
I'm a rambler.
Oh, you're a great storyteller, and that's such a wonderful, you know, little snippet. A tiny wine in a tiny place can have that bigger impression on you, and it doesn't surprise me that you thoroughly enjoyed a little bit of Muscat, perhaps over a Louis Trey. You know, for a new palate, that must have been just a total delicious, sweet little elixir with so much complexity as well. But take me back, because you did study finance, is that right? So before you kind of moved to Australia, I want to hear about that too, but you studied finance, which I imagine is an amazing, you know, skill to have these days in what you do now.
Yeah, so I actually didn't study finance. I studied professional and technical writing, and I worked. This sort of best mentality of like working for the best, working for the biggest. I got this degree and I was like, okay, how am I going to monetize this? Because a tech writer, I mean, I could have written sort of copy for, you know, ad agencies, or you can write, whatever a tech writer write, you can write contracts, you can work in a law office, you can do these things. But I was fascinated by like private client, like there was this, I had discovered that there was this side of banking that I didn't know about. Like my banking at that time was like, oh, you put money in, you take money out. You know, we had ATMs and checks. I was writing a check for my rent and things like that. But there was like this other sort of side of banking, wealth management, and people that needed, you know, their wealth managed. Well, you know, it was just bizarre to me because I had never been exposed to it before. So I wanted to, and banks, financial institutions need people to write and maintain copy for them, right? So you get these huge pamphlets at that time of information about loan agreements and loan servicing and terms and all these things. And they needed someone, they need people to do that for them. So I applied to work at US Bank, which was like the fifth largest bank in the world or something at that point. I don't know. In a technical writing role. And I was like, okay, this is great. Like I was really, really pursuing, I think, my idea of the American dream, right? Such that, you know, you don't work in a restaurant. You need to get a white collar job and go work at a bank or go work at a, you know, an agency or do something with, make your degree worth it, you know, because you've paid all this money and you've committed all this time. And, you know, and my parents were certainly that generation was like, go to college, go to, get a degree, get an education, you know, because they didn't have that, you know, and, or they didn't have access to that. And they saw it as sort of, I guess, a handicap. So I did that, you know, I went to university, I've committed to university, and then I needed to find a way to monetize this degree. Well, come to find out, when you work for a financial institution like that, they put you through like pretty much a de rigueur. Like you have to learn everything about every facet of the business in order to be finally in your role. So the first 6 months I was in branches, in, you know, bouncing around from branch to branch and spending a little bit of time at the corporate office through training and stuff like that. And you had to get bizarro amounts of clearance and things like that. And I was like, hold on a second, this is not what I signed up for. This is not what I want to be doing. This is, you know what I mean? And then there's a lot of complexity there as well with some situations that I had with, you know, my partner, a relationship that was failing, that I, you know, that I was under the impression that I had a really, really skewed idea of love. And that turns into the whole, like, me discovering my sexuality and that whole, it was all happening in like 2008, 2009, you know what I mean? When I was going on. So I was pursuing this career path that I really wasn't happy with, that I, you know, I had felt at that time that I was in too deep. I had this partner that I was under the impression that we were in love and this was going to be the end and this is just fantastic. And we had met each other's parents and it was, you know, I mean, and I don't hold ill will toward very many people. So it was just a matter of fact. And then I had a situation with my mom, where I was pretty much her primary caregiver as she was, you know, very slowly and stubbornly losing the battle with cancer and things like this. So it was all sort of happening. And again, if people listening to this that have heard me talk before, it is a very vivid story of a Wednesday doing up my tie in my closet and just getting ready to go to work and thinking, like, today's the day. This is it. I'm done. Can't do this. No way. No. Pump the brakes. We're done. Get rid of, you know, done. Something major has to happen right now. A major U-turn has to happen right now, or it'll never happen again. It won't happen. So I was at a bank branch. They had put me there for, I think I was there for like 2 weeks or something like that. And sort of getting ready. We were in the middle of a project. And I remember sitting down at my desk and doing my resignation letter on my computer and printing it at the office, the very basic thing. And took it to the project manager that was like, there was the branch manager that was handling, like, you know, like people coming to the counter and doing banking. And then there was the project team and like my team manager. And I just, I went to her and I was like, look, I really hate to do this, but today's my last day. And she just sort of looked at me and I was like, and here's my letter if you need it to be official. But I'm not coming back, you know? And she just looked at me and the famous word that I'll never forget is, you know, with conduct like this, you will never get a job in financial services again. And I just looked at her and I was like, look, with all due respect, let's make sure that doesn't happen. And, you know, all the best. Thank you very much. And, I don't really remember anything after that. I'm pretty sure I filled out the shift that they needed me for or something like that, or maybe a bit of a handover, I suspect. Cause I remember, I mean, I was pretty much autonomous at that point. But anyway, and that's it. And so I left. And and then the details are a bit sort of fuzzy there. But I mean, maybe fast forward a couple of weeks. Because at that point, I was in Milwaukee and I was working for another restaurant, which was the best, the most iconic at that stage. Everybody kind of knew it and went there. And it was a French bistro. And so I was kind of doing both. I would work at the bank during the day and then moonlight a couple of nights at the restaurant, which was great. And I really liked it. And it was busy and big. And, there were professional waiters there now, which was super cool, you know. And they'll never listen to this podcast, I don't think. But they really made a strong impact in, you know, my maturity as a professional in the dining room, which I'm super, super grateful for. And there are so many stories from that restaurant as well. Like, wow. And I thought I knew, you know, and that's the thing too. It's interesting, isn't it? You know, in this industry, and I think in life, you go from position to position thinking that, all right, now I'm fully actualized, fully rounded individual. Like I get it. I understand. And then you take a new role with more responsibilities and to step up and more everything. And you're like, oh shit, I know nothing, you know? And it's like, God, when is it going to stop? You know? And even talking, when I talk to Leanne, you know, she's like, that doesn't ever stop. You know? Yeah, great. Thanks. So I walked into Lake Park Bistro in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I was like, this is, you know, coming from, you know, from this little restaurant, you know, with Larry Turcotte. And I was like, oh, I know everything now. I know Louis Trez and I know about this and that. And walked in, and my first day at this restaurant, I was hosting, right? And, Scott Williams, general manager, I hope he listens to this because I have a lot of respect for Scott, pulls me out back on the little portiere on the patio in the back of the restaurant. And he looks at me and he's like, tell me why our most important VIP at table 13 said I have an arrogant little prick working on the front desk. And I looked at him and I was like, what? I was like, what? I didn't say anything to 13. I just said hello. I didn't, you know what I mean? He just looks at me and I was just in shock. I was like, this is it. I'm going to lose my job. Great. You know, like now what, you know, what's going on? And, you know, from there I learned about how to be, you know, I had to learn how to be affable and approachable and read the guest and, you know, do things like that. Because I was thinking I was in this formal environment and I needed to speak really formally and act very formally. And that was coming across as rude and arrogant and things like that. And it's like, wow. You know, because I never operated in these environments as a kid, you know. So I had to learn all that stuff. And it's and I'll never forget that, you know. And then I didn't lose my job. He kept me. He believed in me. And I was really, really humbled by that moment. You know, it's another moment. First pour the wine and then the arrogant little prick comment. And it was just like, wow. You know, I was like, oh my God. And then he kept me. He didn't fire me, which is amazing, you know. And I grew up a lot in that dining room as well. I grew up a lot in that dining room. And I think but we can talk more about that as well, because that was where I first discovered like wine in detail. And but anyway, so I was still working at the restaurant at that stage. I'm rambling. And so my partner kissed him goodbye on a Sunday. Have a good day at work. I'll see you when you get back. He was managing a hotel. And all my friends came over. We packed up everything. Took everything out. Removalists were there at 5 p.m. Took everything out. I left. I couldn't get the bed out of the room because it had been built in the bedroom, so I couldn't get it out. So I left the bed. Left him a mattress and some water for his cat. And I haven't seen him since. And went to my friends and we had a big party. So I had quit my job. I had left my partner quite dramatically. If anybody knows me, I don't do anything. I'm very rarely calm, cool, collected when making massive life decisions. And that's it. And then I sat with Maddie Johns. I hope she listens to this podcast as well, because she's hugely instrumental. And she had the opportunity to get a visa to go and work in financial services in London as an extern or an internship. I don't really know. And I had discovered that you can go to New Zealand and get a working holiday visa and it doesn't cost anything. I was like, oh, okay, well, let's do that. So we sat at Altera on Prospect at this little table that occasionally, whenever I'm back in town, I go and just sit and have a coffee at that table. And we both kind of hit return on our computers and sent our visa applications off, and we both got accepted. I got the notification in the middle of the night that I was going to New Zealand or I had this visa. I bought a one-way ticket and she bought a one-way ticket. And she now is married with a youngster living in the UK, loving her life. And, you know, 13 years later, I'm here in Melbourne, Australia, kind of pursuing a really, really a career that I feel fulfilled in and that I love to go to work every day. And, you know, yeah, so that's the long way around how Anthony left a job in financial services and eventually ended up in Melbourne, Australia via New Zealand. Yeah.
I love that. I mean, you could have robbed the bank, you know, at one stage there when you were tying your tie in the mirror, I thought, man, this guy could go in and rob the bank. Who knows what this guy is capable of? So I think that quitting your job and leaving your partner and starting afresh was definitely the right way forward from that situation. But I'm amazed at some of those things you talked about, those steep learning curves. I probably can rattle off, you know, some moments like that where I really, you know, had a step wrong, or like you said, was completely oblivious to something that you should have known or you just had no idea of. Now in your life today, you look after numerous younger SOMs. You understand that learning curve is so instrumental. How do you handle, you know, when something like that now occurs with some of the people that you're responsible for? If there's a moment, how do you kind of combat that? I'm sure you don't start poking them in the chest and swearing at them. What do you do about that? Because you know how much it can influence somebody.
Yeah, let me start off by saying, I mean, we have a mutual friend in common who also just so happens to be my boss, who is hands down, without a doubt, the best mentor, right? And I talk to young people as well sometimes, and I, especially after the Master of Wine and things like this, there's a huge difference between a mentor and a coach, right? So Leanne Altman is my boss. She's also my coach, right? She tells me, hey, this is where you need to be. You know, if an athlete is not performing in a certain way or performing in a way that would ultimately result in harm, things like that, she's there to be like, you need to do this, 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 you're doing this wrong. Like, make sure, you know, correct it here, put this there. You know what I mean? She's a coach, but she's also a mentor. So she's really, really instrumental in the way that I approach young SOMs. And my approach has definitely matured over the years. And I'm proud to say that, but I'm also, it must be said that, you know, well, we haven't always been this way. So I was the fiery, you know, saying rude things. I've done that. I own that. You know, we have to own that. I'm not denying that, but, in my current role and today, and it happened just recently, just this week, you really have to assist them in understanding the gravity and being like, so this happened. This mistake happened. How do we get there? So like, is there a procedural issue? Like, did something, have I let you down somehow where I haven't, you know, I haven't given you the tools or I haven't given you the explanation about why we conduct our business this way? And how are we going to make sure that doesn't happen again? You know? And I think often those are stern conversations still, but they're done. They need to be done in a way that's respectful and that really sort of pays respect to the difficulty of their job. And, you know, it's really brave to step up and put your hand up at the possibility of failing at something new. You know, like if you've never done this before or you've done it in a lesser extent or in a less pressure environment, I mean, you walk into Gimlet. I mean, we all know if you've been, it's dramatic. It's, you know, it's big. It has a vibe. It glows. It makes you feel, and you know, you can be wrapped up in that. And there's a lot of moving parts, and, you know, there's people hustling everywhere, and it's just, it has a buzz, you know, and, but that buzz is, you know, can be pretty high pressure for, you know, for a young SOM or for a young waiter. So, I think when those things happen now, really just understanding the gravity, and it's always needs to be done sort of after and not in public, you know, like you don't want to publicly, you know, you don't, you know, after service, I mean, in service, correct it, be like, okay, that was, we need to fix that right now. Like right now, you know, without delay, please, table 32 without delay. But also after, you know, being like, what happened there? You know, and having those conversations being like, you know, and recently it happened with a junior, and, I wasn't directly supervising the incident. One of the senior sommeliers was, and the senior sommeliers certainly had their words with this junior who were bringing up, you know, to be the next SOM. But afterwards, I'm like, bro, I'm like, do you realize that, like, that's mega? Like, that was big time. Like, that was a big, big fuck up. That cannot happen again, you know? And he's just like, yeah, you know, I get it. I understand. This is what happened, blah, blah. And I was like, okay, well, in the future, let's make sure that, especially with tables like that, you know, it was a really sort of high profile table, you know, that we just take a breath, take a step, and then act, you know? With everything, whether you're setting the next course, looking at your cutlery, take a breath, take a step. Okay, pasta's next. This is correct. And then you go, you know, make sure that you're looking at the decanter and you're looking at it and you're like, okay, this is Merso. Now off we go, you know, and pour it into the right glass and things like that. So, you know, I won't go into detail, but
no, don't, because that poor junior might be listening. But
might be listening. Junior is listening.
I love what you've said about the gravitas of the situation, because I think what has stayed with me from moments where I've made mistakes is understanding why it was a big deal. And when you have made a mistake like that and you've learned from it, it does stay with you, just like you said. But at the same time, you know, I've had many conversations with people where they're just like, oh, whatever, you know, the guest didn't even notice. Like, it's not rocket science. We're not saving lives. It's just a restaurant. But when you work in some of the best and every person that shows up that day is asking themselves for their best performance every single day, it is a big deal in that scenario. And so, yeah, nobody died, but if you have that kind of lax attitude of whatever, everyone's going to be fine, don't get your knickers in a knot, then you should work at a different restaurant.
and it's interesting, I mean, you know, as we've sort of grown into Gimlet and Gimlet's grown into us and kind of understanding, you know, what it means and, you know, the occasion that it is, you know, for a lot of people, it's really easy. It's easier now to have those conversations like, hey, you know, and this junior in this incident was definitely not lax. They were, he understood. And I think that's the only thing we can ask for, really, is like, hey, take a breath, take a step back, chill out, you know, like, just before you, especially with a table like that, just make sure that you're double checking everything, that you're, you know, you're on top of it. And I think, yeah, you know, if we ever get someone that has that sort of lax attitude, those are just conversations. That's kind of like, hey, you know what? You're now working in one of the most visible dining rooms in the country. So I think if you're not taking this seriously, maybe somewhere else, you know, and we want to retain them as well. So somewhere else in the group, even, you know, if you want something a little bit more relaxed, we've got, you know, and that's ultimately Leanne's direction. She would handle any sort of anything like that. But, you know, there's opportunities everywhere if this is not for you, you know, and that's the thing that I love about the way that where the industry is going. And I don't know if I can speak for the wider industry, but I can certainly speak for us that, you know, we always take that sort of employee first approach. Like, if you're not happy here or we're seeing a lack of performance, is this a symptom of a problem? Is this a symptom or is this the problem? Like, if you're finding it difficult to work in a big, busy, noisy dining room, so fine. We'll find something calm, quiet, cool. You can make coffees at morning market or something like that. So there's, you know what I mean?
I love that, because it's appreciating the individual and their skills that says, you know what, this might not be the right fit, but that doesn't mean that you don't have skills. They just can be utilized elsewhere. And I really like that approach. And that is one of the benefits of working for some larger groups with bigger opportunities. And I think that that is something that people really need to consider when they're applying for jobs. And on that note, what advice would you give to perhaps somebody that's interested in wine that wants to be a sommelier one day or in your position? What is the best advice you can give them on going about that?
Well, I think the best advice that I can give is find someone or a place that you really feel you can flourish. And unfortunately, you're going to have to do a lot of work. I think that's the thing that if I can give any advice is, unfortunately, more often than not, and potentially to your chagrin, you're going to have to work really, really hard outside of the limelight. You're going to have to go home and after a shift and be exhausted and still pick up a book. Or you're going to have to get up early and you're going to have to pick up a book and you're going to have to read and take notes and study. And then you're not going to have to, you're not going to necessarily be able to apply that knowledge right away. And I think that's, you know, you have to be a, you have, yeah, you have to do a lot of work, you know? And if I had a young person in front of me, I would tell them, like, also, don't complain straight away. Like, you, and understand that you need to find someone that's going to give you opportunities, but that person doesn't owe you opportunities. You're going to have to earn them. So find a place that you're comfortable, even if it's a little wine bar, you know, but make sure always that you're not the smartest one in the room, and find the smartest one in the room. You know what I mean? And learn from them. But that's all driven by you. It's not driven by them. They don't owe you anything. You have to earn that. And earning that sometimes means keeping your mouth shut and plunging the toilet. And do you know what I mean? Look,
it's so true. I don't know if anyone has summed up that question better than those last few sentences that you just said. Honestly, that is the best answer I've had ever to that. It's so true. It's so true. And I love when you said you may, you know, read some information and then you're learning something, but you don't always apply it straight away. And that is so true. Just because you've read about something and you feel armed with that information, you don't go to the first guest you see and regurgitate it.
No. And I remember walking into to a little restaurant on Waiheke Island in New Zealand and sitting down and being like, hi, I've just arrived from the United States. I've decided that I'm going to monetize wine. I'm going to make this my career. I had no idea what I was doing. I think I had like $150 or something like that. It's just stupid. And I was like, I want to learn how to make wine, but I don't know how to work in restaurants. So if you teach me how to make wine, I'll work in your restaurant for you. Like thinking like this is going to be like a quid pro quo sort of thing. And they're like, yeah, sure. We'll pay you. You know, so they paid me $17 an hour. And I'll never forget that restaurant was so small that everybody did everything. So I had to go in the morning and open and clean the toilets. And I remember cleaning the toilets and thinking in my head, you've just came from an office job in America, and here you are on some island in the South Pacific cleaning a toilet because you've decided you want to make wine. And I just remember in my head being like, just shut up and do it. Just shut up and do it. And I that's the similar sort of advice that I would give young people if they want to be a sommelier. Like that's, yeah. So anyway, that's
where I'm at. I don't know what it is with the further you get in restaurants and management, the more toilets you do actually clean. There's something wrong there, or the more spew that you end up cleaning up, there's definitely something wrong.
But also shout out to every single restaurant manager and supervisor that has ever had to actually do that, because it's very rarely the Psalms these days. You know what I mean? There's those poor people. Every now and then it happens. I know it must happen to you, or has happened to you, where you're like, oh God, no.
Oh, more times than I can count. I'm an expert in that business. And it really helped me with, you know, going forth into the realms of having children. So, you know, it has come in useful.
True.
I'd like to know, you know, in terms of your job now, what is it that gets you out of bed each day? What is the moments that you think, this is why I do this? Because I know that with your job now, there's added responsibility. I'm sure there's plenty of stock takes and not so fun things as well. But what is the part that you enjoy most about your job?
Look, Shante, to be honest with you, it's more about people these days. Like it's less about the product. And I guess, you know, my big wins, things that make me feel really fulfilled in my role, are of course, you know, finding those products that, you know, that allow us to do, you know, fun things in the dining room, you know, whether it's a, you know, a cool deal on champagne or something where we can, you know, then kind of use that savings to buy something fun or things like this. But ultimately it's seeing the people that I work with or that I work for, that work under me, I guess, under me, but I don't like the way that sounds, but seeing their successes, you know, like that was so fulfilling, you know. You know, we have a young supervisor in the room, and you know, I'll try to paint a picture for you. You know, it's like super hectic Friday night. It is chock busy, line at the door, stuff's going off, and it's pouring rain outside, and it's just like heaving. Gimlet is heaving. And there's a manager on the floor, of course. There's always a manager on the floor, like a big dog, you know, someone who can step in for major issues, you know what I mean? And they generally fly under the radar. They're almost always a host. You would never really know. It's not like that sort of restaurant. Everybody does everything. And then there are two supervisors kind of on each side of the room that kind of manage. So there's generally three top dogs. And then two somms. So it's usually, you know, and I look like every other sommelier. So there's nobody really knows, which is fine, which I actually appreciate. Pouring rain, hugely busy night. And table 15, solo diner, limited English, is convinced that she has eaten glass. And the supervisor comes to me and she's like, I'm not really sure. She's new, right? She's in her 20s. She's like, I don't really know what to do. And I was like, well, what have you done? She's like, well, I took the plate away. And I was like, great. And what did you do with it? And she's like, well, I threw it away. And I was like, okay, probably not the best decision, but what is the guest doing right now? And she's like, well, the guest is on their phone. And I was like, okay, we're kind of out in the back. And I was like, where's the manager? And no one can find the manager. And I'm starting to get really heated because I'm like, I need someone that's in a suit that has some big time responsibilities to step in this situation because it's urgent and very important. It's critically important. And she's in the back and we can't find the manager. And so I start escalating this situation, creating a bit of a buzz. I'm like, where is this manager? Somebody, I was grabbing everybody, anybody passing by, where's the manager? Nobody knows where the manager is. And I'm like, first of all, that's very uncharacteristic. In my head, I'm going down the rabbit hole of like, they've decided to just step off and go to the office or something, which is bizarre because it was heaving. Come to find out, the manager can't be found because our basement next door is also flooding. So the manager is over there managing that situation. So once I find that out, I look back at this young supervisor and I'm like, well, this is for you. You need to handle this. And I was like, here's what we're going to do next. You know, and I just took it very, very calmly. And I was like, first thing we need to do is we need to make sure that there's no injury, right? We need to make sure that if this guest is convinced that she has consumed something like this, we need to immediately give her strong recommendation that she seek medical help if she's convinced. And if she's not currently actively injured, then we just need to make sure that we leave our details and ensure her that she needs to seek medical advice and that someone will follow up straight away. It's kind of like protocol procedure sort of thing. And she just looks at me, she's like, okay, you know, she's quite frazzled. And I was like, I understand how emotional you are right now, but what you need to give to the guest is calm, control, precision. Can you do that for me? And she's like, yeah, I can do that. I was like, okay, so go back. I need you to give her the contact information of our general manager, assure her that there was no glass in her food. And that if she is convinced that she's consumed glass, we highly recommend that she seek medical attention and someone will follow up with her first thing in the morning. You know, and seeing her sort of click into this mode of totally objective, emotionless control and power, I was just so those are the times where I'm like, wow. And then I took her aside after, you know, the guest ended up not eating glass, and it was a big huge sort of misunderstanding, and the lack of English kind of got in the way and everything like that. But it was in the moment, it was very heated. And took her aside afterwards, and I was like, what do you need from me right now? You know, and she's like, I think I just need to have a cry. And I was like, well, then just, it's so fine. Take some time, have a glass of water, have a wee cry, come back. And, you know, and after she's like, wow, thank you so much. I've never had to do anything like that before, blah, blah, blah. And I think those are some of the most fulfilling times in my, you know, in my career now. And certainly within wine as well, you know, I have two senior sommeliers underneath me, and they're absolutely incredible professionals, and, you know, teaching them how to effectively negotiate a big tender, you know, a big deal, you know, like I'm like, these, you know, you're writing professional emails to importers and suppliers, you know, for tens of thousands of dollars over time. So this is big time, you know, this is something that maybe they've never done before. And just to see them now handle things, you know, so with such a casual, collected way. I mean, that sort of development for me is what really makes me proud. It's what really sort of drives me and gets me out of bed in the morning. And also above me, Like, you know, I have a 9 a.m. meeting every Thursday. I look forward to that meeting so much. And sometimes I get caned in that meeting. Sometimes I'm like, oh, I fucked it up, you know, or I haven't done this, or, you know, and my boss is very exacting, you know, so she, you know, she's like, tell me about this state of play here, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, this is where I'm at, blah, blah. And she's like, okay, good, but not great. Tweak this, do that, blah, blah. You know, so those meetings are not, they're not full of, you know, oh, Anthony, you're so amazing. And, but I love it. You know, it makes me, I walk out of that meeting, you know, energized, you know, sometimes maybe a little bit defeated just between you and I, like, oh, fuck, god damn, you know, like, I'm really hard on myself, you know, why didn't I think of that? Well, you know, but most of the time that weekly meeting gets me out of bed as well, because the person above me cares so much, and the person above me is equally invested in me as she expects I am in the people below me. And I think that really pays testament to the quality and the power of the organization as a whole, but also like our little nugget, our little department that could, I guess. And so that's kind of what gets me out of bed in the morning.
Yeah. God, I mean, I feel like if there was ever a crisis, I would love to have you near. Melbourne is not close enough, because certainly your leadership and the way that you conduct yourself and others is something to be really, really proud of. I know Leanne is, that knows she's very lucky to have you, but yeah, you're a total inspiration, and I really appreciate the way that you're able to articulate what you're talking about and what you love, because it's certainly some of the best parts I've enjoyed in the hospitality industry too. Now, I do want to delve in, but we're going to have to save it for another podcast, but I want to delve into the perfectionist in you and why you have such high ambition all the time, but I'll have to wait to the next one. So I've got one more question, and it's rapid fire. Three beverages for the rest of your life, what would they be and why?
Three beverages for the rest of my life, Jesus. Well, it would be champagne, just between us. If anybody knows me, it needs to be bubbly or not. I mean, you could certainly have flat champagne. It would be champagne just because it's celebratory. You can open it when there's something to be celebrated. You can have it with food. You can have it on the beach. You can think about it if you want. You know, you can have really incredibly cerebral gastronomic examples, or you can just have light, fresh, bubbly. I just love it. Champagne is awesome. I also think three beverages. Well, I don't know. She's not really very addictive, but she loves her coffee. So I guess probably coffee in all of its forms, whether it's, you know, tamped tight and pressed into espresso, or, you know, a drip coffee that I love going back and having that strong American coffee really, really gets the ticker going. So probably coffee. And I guess there's enough water in both of those to keep you sustained. I don't know the third, Shantae. I don't know. I for some odd reason, I want to go to the dry fortified wines of Jerez as well. Yeah, I just think there's just some sort of like salty, tangy. They're just beguile. I just love
that. Are we like Manzanilla or like Palo Cortado, or like where are we yeah, realming?
All of them. I mean, look, the thing that I love, I mean, as well, and if you need to cut me off at any, but like the thing that I love about Palo Cortado, right, and I could be wrong, so if there are any really studious psalms here, I might get called out, which is fine, but Palo Cortado is solely an organoleptic sort of qualification. So there's nothing that says Palo Cortado is Palo Cortado, like Manzanilla or like Amontillado. Like, it's just someone says that's a Palo Cortado. And I think that's just amazing. You know what I mean? So it's like the most broad spectrum, organoleptic, subjective, wine, probably in the world of wine. I mean, I'm happily corrected with more examples, which there probably are, because I'm an old man and I have the short-term memory of a gnat. Can't really remember much these days. But so yes, Palo Cortado, yes, Manzanilla. I think all you need to do really, like Burgundy, yeah, go and take your picture in front of Romani Conti, and I get it. And yes, you should go and understand it and all those things. But until you're sitting there in the south of Spain drinking cheap, cheap manzanilla, cheap fino out of a little glass and having salty anchovies or tomatoes or cheese, and you're sweating and it's hot and it kind of has a weird smell, just dirty old city smell. Don't talk to me about any sort of homage pilgrimage. I mean, Alsace is beautiful as well. And South Africa, fuck. But anyway, but until you're there doing that, I mean, just for me, So champagne in all of its glorious forms, including the lovely ratafias, coffee again in all of its forms, whether it's dripped or pressed or into espresso, or when you're having shitty instant coffee sitting on a balcony in Buenos Aires with your shitty croissants in the morning with the most delicious dulce de leche you could possibly imagine. Coffee in all of its forms, and probably the I'm trying to think of, but it would be the dry wines of the dry fortified or not. Sorry, Scott Walsley from TSA, the dry fortified or not, Marco de Jerez wines from Spain.
Yeah. They're complex, aren't they? That would probably be on my list too, because I just find when I think, okay, desert island, I've got a drink, but what it like ticks boxes and I can like sit with for hours and discover new things. Yeah. Jerez is right up there for me. So I love all those options. I drink a lot of champagne and a lot of coffee. So we are going to come back to why you're such a perfectionist, why you strive to be at the very top of your game, your whole life incarnate, in another podcast. But Anthony, it's been such a pleasure. What a treat for me on my Friday to have this conversation with you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Shante. Yeah, look, I really appreciate you having me. Sorry, I'm a rambler, but yeah. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
This is Over a Glass. I'm Shante Whale. Stay tuned for more stories from the world of wine and drinks. Listen in every Thursday on your podcast app. Follow us on Instagram at Over a Glass Pod and contact us at overaglass@deepintheweeds.com.au.